From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Glenn Close. She plays the vice president in Air Force One, which will open this summer, and she plays Cruella de Vil in 101 Dalmatians, which is now out on video. We'll feature an interview recorded last year. Also out on video, the restored version of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the 1964 French film starring Catherine Deneuve, in which all the dialogue is sung. We'll hear from Michel Legrand, who composed the music for the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Prosecutors have rested their case in the penalty phase of the Oklahoma City bombing trial. The last witness talked about how he comforted his young son over the death of his mother in the bombing 2 years ago. The defense this hour begins its work of trying to persuade jurors to spare convicted bomber Timothy McVeigh's life. New York City authorities continue to search for the person responsible for killing the son of Time Warner executive Gerald Levin. Police say someone aware of the family's wealth may have been responsible. From member station WNYC, Richard Hake reports.
New York City detectives are questioning a 19-year-old former student of Jonathan Levin, according to an unidentified police source. But no arrests have been made. Levin was found bound, stabbed, and shot in the head in his Manhattan apartment. He was an English teacher at a Bronx high school and apparently mentioned in class a few weeks ago that his father was the head of Time Warner Incorporated. The 31-year-old was tortured for his automatic bank teller card and its secret code and then murdered. A withdrawal of $800 was taken from his bank account. Police are now looking at a grainy videotape from the bank. They are trying to identify the person who used the card, but they are sure it was not Levin. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Hake in New York.
Federal investigators are trying to find out why a fireworks factory blew up yesterday in Tennessee. The blast killed four workers at the plant in La Follette. The plant's owner says no one is sure what happened and the cause may never be discovered. Apparently, nothing's left of the metal shipping container that originally blew up. The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has sent in agents and a response team, including chemists. Sierra Leone's coup leaders are asking for more international help in negotiating an end to the crisis in the West African nation. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Abidjan.
The new rulers clearly want to avoid a showdown with a growing and better trained multinational force. Nigerian military officers say there are now nearly 4,000 soldiers from at least three countries deployed near Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. And since Nigerians still control the main airport, that force could expand more. The president of nearby Ivory Coast has reportedly been approached about brokering a truce. Ivory Coast hosted previous peace talks between Sierra Leone's army and rebels. Now those groups are allied against an ousted elected government whose president has sought refuge in Guinea. Any talks must reconcile Ahmed Tidjane Kaba's claim that he remains head of state with the coup maker's insistence that he step down. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Abidjan.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 138 points at 74.43. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the government reports the nation's jobless rate continues to drop. It's at its lowest level in about a quarter of a century. The unemployment rate fell a tenth of a percent in May to 4.8%. The rate's dropped 4 months in a row. The U.S. Interior and Commerce Departments are moving to formally adopt two policies to provide incentives so private landowners will help protect endangered plant and animal species. Joel Southern reports.
For the past few years, Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt has negotiated voluntary agreements with landowners to show the Endangered Species Act is flexible enough to protect species at risk and private property rights. Now, Babbitt and Commerce Secretary William Daley want to make permanent two incentive programs for landowners. Babbitt says one, called Candidate Conservation, is aimed at heading off problems with species on track for threatened or endangered status.
We simply sit down with landowners and say, how can we manage the land to eliminate the threat?
The other policy, called Safe Harbors, provides land use incentives to help listed species recover. Attorney Michael Bean of the Environmental Defense Fund says incentive agreements are crucial because much of the critical habitat for endangered species is on private land. For National Public Radio, I'm Joel Southern in Washington.
Long-distance phone companies Xcel and Telco Communications say they plan to merge. The value of the deal is worth about $1.2 billion. Telco is a so-called dial-around phone company selling a service allowing customers to use an access code to dial around the long-distance carrier and access its own network. Xcel uses its customers as sales agents to market itself. It leases space on other firms' networks and then sells its service to customers. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Glenn Close, recorded last year. In July, she'll co-star in the thriller Air Force One. She'll play the vice president dealing with the hijacking of the entire first family. Close plays a prisoner of war in the World War II drama Paradise Road, which is in current release, and she plays the evil Cruella de Vil in Disney's 101 Dalmatians, which has recently come out on video. One of the most respected actresses of her generation, Glenn Close has won 3 Tony Awards, including one for her performance as the faded film star Norma Desmond in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Sunset Boulevard. She also received Academy Award nominations for her roles in the films The Big Chill, The World According to Garp, The Natural, Dangerous Liaisons, and Fatal Attraction. In Fatal Attraction, one of her best-known films, she played a psychotic woman who has a brief affair with a married man, played by Michael Douglas. When he tries to break it off, she refuses to leave him alone and begins stalking him and his family. In this scene, Douglas's character, Dan, confronts Close's character, Alex.
I don't know what you're up to, but I'm going to tell you it's going to stop right now.
No, it's not going to stop. It's going to go on and on until you face up to your responsibilities.
My responsibilities!
I'm pregnant. I'm going to have our child.
Alex, that's your choice, honey. That has nothing to do with me.
I just want to be a part of your life.
Oh, this is the way you do it, huh? Showing up at my apartment?
What am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
You don't get it. You don't get it.
Don't you remember our weekend? It wasn't that wonderful. Why can't we just be like that again? I know you feel it, too. I mean, what are you so afraid of?
Hey, just don't flatter yourself, Alex. You're so sad. You know that, Alex? Lonely and very sad.
Don't you ever pity me, oh, smug bastard.
I'll pity you, because you're sick.
Why? Because I won't allow you to treat me like some slut you can just bang a couple of times and throw in the garbage? I'm going to be the mother of your child. I want a little respect.
You want respect. Respect.
What are you doing? Please, Dan, please don't go. I didn't mean it. Please, I'm sorry. I'll tell your wife.
You tell my wife, I'll kill you.
You were 35 when you had your first film role, The World According to Garp. Had you tried for movies earlier on?
Yes, but not very well. I've never been good at walking into a room as me and convincing somebody that I can play somebody else. I've always been very, very uncomfortable. And I think my career has literally been one evidence of what I can do leading to another, you know. And a lot of times, even when people see you in something, they don't necessarily think you in another kind of role. They fit you into what you've done before.
So had you auditioned for roles but not auditioned well before?
Well, it was a lot of... Yeah, I guess. It's very hard when you're handed 2 pages out of a 115-page script.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that was rather unfair.
You don't know who you are.
Or the stacking of... Yeah, you know, yeah, it's like, you know, if you're lucky. I always never minded if I didn't get cast if I felt I'd shown them my best, then I never minded it because I thought, well, you know, you can only do your best. The frustrating thing times is when you're sitting there and you can feel that edge slowly draining out the ends of your fingertips, and it's desperate because it all becomes terribly kind of psychological. And when you feel that you haven't shown your best, that's very difficult. And I must say, I have written letters and asked if I could please come back. And sometimes people let you and sometimes they don't.
So did you audition for GARP and did the audition go well?
I auditioned for GARP and it was very funny actually because the description of that character that went out to all the agents was a young Katharine Hepburn type. So I auditioned for George Roy Hill and Marion Dougherty, who was a great, the, kind of the dean of movie casting people. And I literally was kind of talking like Katharine Hepburn. And George said later that it was probably the worst audition he'd ever seen. But he'd also seen me in Barnum, and there was something about, he told me later, the stillness that I had on stage and kind of my, I suppose, straight backbone that made him think I could do Jenny Fields.
Fatal Attraction was a role that just really kind of stunned people. This was a role you really went after, I think. This is a role you asked to audition for?
I met with Stanley Jaffe, who's one of the producers, and I remember meeting him in a hotel lobby in New York, and we had tea or something, and I had a little demure kind of summer straw hat on and a loose kind of peasant dress. I couldn't have been more opposite of Alex Forrest, but I had felt very passionately about the character, and I was able to kind of articulate to him the kind of thing that I was thinking about, and I guess that interested him and him enough to ask that I do a audition with Michael Douglas on video out in California, which I then did, and I thought, I wanted to kill myself afterwards. I thought for sure I hadn't gotten the part.
Why?
Because it was just so, I mean, pleased to walk into a room and there's Michael Douglas and a video camera set up. It's pretty intimidating. And I had long hair at the time, and I didn't know what to wear, so I went to a store and I found this black, wonderful cotton dress. At that time, it had big shoulders and a very small waist and kind of a great skirt. And I wore that, and then that morning I didn't know what to do with my hair. I've never been good knowing how to do my own hair, so I just, I'll just let it go wild. I can't deal with it. So my hair was all over the place. I had that black dress on. And then I was so nervous that I took, I think, a half of Valium, which I never do. And I remember kind of weaving across the parking lot to get to the audition. And, you know, then go up, there's the camera, there's Adrian Lyne, and what happened.
Now, I know the ending of Fatal Attraction was reshot. You didn't want it to be reshot. And you protested it, but what could you do to protest it when the ending was rewritten?
Just refused to do it. Because I had grown to really love that character very much. I'd done a lot of research about her, and with psychiatrists just to understand, first of all, if her behavior was possible, and then when I found out that it was, to then explore what would create behavior like that. And in that research, I really started to love that character. And she was not a psychopath. She was suicidal. She was self-destructive. And the original script was a beautiful, seamless film noir. And they started kind of tinkering with it. And then we shot the original ending where she kills herself and with the same knife that his fingerprints are on, and he goes off to jail.
So her death frames him.
Yeah, and it was so incredibly upsetting to the American audiences who really like happy endings, and that they reshot it, rewrote it.
So tell me, give me a sense of some of the things you learned from the psychiatrist that really helped you understand the character and figure out how to play her.
Well, in that character, never has a chance to explain to the audience, or the audience never really understands her history or why she's doing what she's doing, so I had to really know myself.
Just for our listeners who haven't seen the movie Fatal Attraction, let me say that your character is a character who basically picks up or helps seduce a married man, and then when he doesn't want to see her anymore, she just goes after him with a vengeance and threatens the safety of the entire family. And becomes,
well, she's also discovered she's pregnant by him.
Right. And the rejection of her sends her into this...
obsession.
Obsession, yeah. Thank you. Retaliative obsession. Retaliatory obsession. Mm. So back to the insights that psychiatrists gave you that helped you understand this character and helped you play her.
Well, it was a long process. But for example, there is a scene where my character sneaks up to their house and looks in the window and sees the parents giving the little girl the pet rabbit. And then she runs away from the window and throws up in the bushes. And I thought, okay. I said, what would cause that? And they said, whatever that she would... She sees herself as that child. And the research and, you know, what we had figured out from her behavior, which actually is impeccably written, is that she was a woman who had probably been sexually abused by her father at a very early age. And when looking in that window, she associates herself with that child. And all those subliminal feelings, all that guilt, all that revulsion comes up when she sees the father being so attentive and loving to the child. And that those feelings and the actual physical feelings that she would have gone through as a child through what her father might have, you know, forced her to do makes her throw up.
Now, could you go to the writer of the screenplay and ask him to share these kinds of insights, or would the writer be more unreliable in understanding the psychological motivation?
I didn't, you know, the writer wasn't around much, but, you know, I didn't need to, because with the work I did with a psychiatrist, he had written a pretty seamless case study.
Uh-huh.
In fact, for 3 years after that movie came out, I was asked to speak to the Association of American Psychiatrists at their big meeting. You know, and I said, why? It was just a character I created. I don't know, but it was that real and that... I guess, believable for them. And I've been told by a lot of psychiatrists that that part brought a lot of people to their couches.
My guest is Glenn Close. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Glenn Close, recorded last year after the release of 101 Dalmatians, which is now out on video. Later this summer, you can see her in the thriller Air Force One. I've just gotten in a copy of your father's memoir, A Doctor's Story, and you wrote the introduction to the book. This is the new paperback edition, and he was a surgeon in Africa for many years before moving back to the States, and he, I think, worked on the first outbreak of the Ebola virus.
Yes.
In Zaire. Mm-hmm. And part of his memoir is set at a time of your life that I know has been a source of a lot of confusion for you, because your father first went to Africa as a member of a group called Moral Rearmament, mm-hmm. which from what I've read and from the way he describes it sounds like part missionary and part cult group.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
You were, well, he was living in Africa, spending some of the time in Africa and some of the time at a boarding school that I think was run by this group?
No. When he first went to Africa, we were in Switzerland, actually, at one of the headquarters for that group. And we actually went down the mountain every morning to quite a raucous English school filled with, you know, kids from all over the place. That was 2 years. And then after that, I came back to America, and I went into Rosemary Hall, which was in Greenwich, Connecticut at the time.
Did you learn interesting things about your father's motivation for being in this group by reading the book?
Yes, I actually, you know, I kind of put off reading the book. I think I was a little wary of reading it, because that was a difficult chapter in our whole family's life. And finally, my mom, who was a magnificent lady, said, "Have you read your dad's book?" And I said, "No." She said, I think you better read it. And so I read it, and I was very, very moved by it. And I'm very proud of my father. I always have been, actually. He's an extraordinary man. And I think the older I get, the more proud I am of both my parents and what they have tried to achieve in the world and the kind of human beings that they are. And I think every family has, dramas and triumphs and tragedies. And I think my family are a group of very diverse, wonderful people.
And then he left Moral Rearmament after they urged him to stop operating, to stop performing surgery and basically return to the pulpit. But he says he was determined to follow his own vocation. How did you leave?
Oh, let's see.
I'm assuming that
the beginning of my, the kind of the thing that marked my being able to get out of the grips of that group was when I went to college. And I was a freshman in college when I was 22 years old. And when I went to college, which was William and Mary in Virginia, I made the conscious decision that I would not trust any of my instincts because I felt they had been fed to me. And for that reason, I really started to come alive. I really started to be myself. And one of the first things I did as a freshman was walk into the theater department and audition for the very first play of the season, which was Twelfth Night.
Now, what made you realize at that point in your life, at this point of great transition and great insecurity in a way, that what you wanted to do was act?
I always had wanted to act.
Oh.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that they never really got me because I always had a sense of what I could do. And I think my dreams probably kept me from being totally brainwashed.
Now, I know you sang for a while with Up With People. Was that connected to...
That was an outcrop of Moral Rearmament. But I think it eventually broke away from it. I've long lost touch with them.
No, I mean, Up With People, as I remember, was just the most kind of square, clean-cut, cheery singing group, or chorus, I guess you could say.
In the 60s.
Yeah. And just as like the world is in this total like chaos of counterculture and rebellion, like Up With People is really there toeing the line, being really, really
freedom isn't free.
Clean cut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it was like to have to sing with a smile all the time. I mean, that's my memories of Up With People too. Everybody's
well, I mean, I had no equipment at the time to get out of it. I mean, I had been basically in something like that from the time I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you do the best you can with the emotional, spiritual equipment that you have. And I think hopefully we always will be evolving and able to take care of ourselves better and better as we go through life. But I had no equipment. And I was incredibly sincere, but I was very manipulated.
Right.
And so it took a while for me to be able to have the wherewithal to break away. And the thing that helped me break away was thinking to myself, I have to get an education. I am ignorant. I am an ignorant person. I have to go to school. And that was what helped me break away.
So did you break away at about the same time your parents did, or was there any conflict
between
you?
No, I was in it longer than they were.
Well,
they were in Africa.
Uh-huh.
I got out of it in 1970, really, when I went to William and Mary.
Did you go through a period of big rebellion after you left?
No, I'd never really been a rebel. But I had terrible dreams. I think a lot of the terrible conflict and anger actually came out in my dreams. For years, I dreamed, first of all, of being totally in their thrall. And slowly in my dreams, I started to, sometimes it was even getting up from a table and walking away, and finally evolved to where I could confront them and say, no, you are wrong. And then I didn't have to dream about it anymore. But I also had, at the same time, an incredible, joyous discovery of theater and something which I had always wanted to do. And I think that sustained me and helped me grow.
Now, I heard from somebody, you can tell me if this is true, that you were thinking of doing a film about your father.
No, I wanted to do a film about Ebola.
Oh.
Back in 1987, when David Putnam was head of Columbia, I marched in and said, because of this, you know, discovering it from my dad, I said there was a discovery in 1976 of this, the most deadly virus known to man in Africa, and I want to go back to the mission where it broke out, and I have this means because of my father's, the connections, and he gave me $25,000 to go back to Africa and research it, and I still think it would make a magnificent movie, but Outbreak kind of makes everybody think they know the story, which is absolutely untrue. But in 1987, I went back to Africa, to Zaire, and we, by just an unbelievable series of circumstances, got ourselves way into Yambuku in the middle of the rainforest and made our way 90 kilometers to the mission. The country now is beyond chaos. Then it was only chaotic. But it was one of the great adventures of my life. And someday maybe the time will come again to tell the story, because it will never not be relevant.
Glenn Close. She's currently starring in the film Paradise Road, and she stars in the thriller Air Force One, which opens in July. Our interview was recorded last year after the release of 101 Dalmatians, which is now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Cruella de Vil, Cruella de Vil. If she doesn't scare you, no evil thing will. To see her is to take a sudden chill. Cruella, Cruella de Vil. The curl of her lips, the ice in her stare. All innocent children had better beware. She's like a spider waiting for the kill. Look out for Cruella de Vil. At first you think Cruella is a devil, but after time is worn away to shock, you come to realize you've seen her kind of eyes watching you from underneath a rock. This vampire bat is inhuman beast. She ought to be locked up and never released. The world was such a wholesome place until Cruella, Cruella de Vil.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, composer Michel Legrand. We're listening to music he composed for the now classic 1964 French film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. All the dialogue in the film is sung to Legrand's music. The new restored edition of the film has just come out on video.
Je suis un peu en retard. Le notaire n'en finissait pas, et je suis passé à la station. Maintenant tout est réglé.
Pauvre Élise, il ne restera rien d'elle.
Si beaucoup de choses au contraire, tout ce que nous allons faire.
Tu es heureux.
Très heureux. C'est à toi que je le dois. Si Madeleine, tu le sais bien. toi, est-ce que tu es heureuse?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The restored edition of the 1964 classic French film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg was released theatrically in America last year, and it was a revelation. Now it's out on home video. Breathtaking isn't too strong a word for the use of color in this film or for the music. All the dialogue is sung to music composed by Michel Legrand, who also composed the music for Yentl, The Summer of 42, and The Thomas Crown Affair. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with Legrand last year. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg was written and directed by the late Jacques Demy, and it made a star of the young actress Catherine Deneuve. Over the years, the colors had faded so badly you'd never know what the film really looked like. The restoration shows the original color. The film tells the story of two young lovers who are broken apart when the young man, Guy, is drafted and sent to Algeria for 2 years. In this scene, the broken-hearted Geneviève, played by Deneuve, begs him not to leave her. He promises to love her for the rest of his life.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne parle pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cacherai et je te garderai. Mais mon amour.
Ce n'est pas possible.
Je ne te quitterai pas.
Mon amour, il faudra pourtant que je parte. Tu sauras que moi, je ne pense qu'à toi. Mais je sais que toi, tu m'attends. Pleure pas, je t'en supplie.
Michel Legrand, how did Jacques Demy first describe to you his idea of a movie in which all the dialogue would be sung?
You know, it went step by step because Jacques came to me once with the, you know, because I've worked with him on two or three movies before. And we always spoke, him and I, about, you know, doing a musical or some musicals for the screen. And one day came to me with a script called The Infidelity of or The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And he wanted to shoot it in black and white, like a normal movie. So I read the script very carefully, 2, 3, 4 times. And then I came back to Jacques and I said, Jacques, I love it, but I think we should try to make a musical out of it. I said to him, you know, it would be maybe very interesting to do it as a musical. Oh, Jacques said, hey, what a good idea. So we started to work. And first of all, we wanted to make it as a normal musical with spoken parts and singing parts. And we wrote a song here, we tried another song there, and it never worked really well because we had a big problem between the passage, between what's spoken and what was sang. So I said, oh, you know, today it's impossible to really, then people that talk normally and suddenly we hear the background, you know, the strings coming and say, oh, they're going to sing now. And all these kind of old-fashioned, you know, sounds, we said, no, that's not for us. So we abandoned the project. Said, no, I don't think it's a musical. And a few months later, Jacques said, you know, I have an idea because we have a problem gluing what's spoken, what's sang. Why don't we try to sing the entire movie? Like an opera from beginning to end. Hey, I said, geez, why not? So we started. And it took us a couple of months to really try to find which style, because I remember, you know, I was working by myself at home, and I started to write some, you know...
Actually, let me stop here, because I want to get to the part about the style in a moment.
Yeah.
But first I'd like to know your reaction when Jacques Demy said, well, let's do it like an opera where everything is sung. Did you think, hey, what a great idea? Or did you think he was a little crazy?
No, because Jacques wasn't a crazy man. No, I said, you know, oh, I think it's a good idea. We should try. And then we tried, and I couldn't find, because, you know, when I started to work on it, it was very complicated, you know, classical, very modern classical music. And I said, and Jacques and I, we said to ourselves, you know, it should be, if we do something like that, it should be, music should be readable and understandable. The first time, Jacques said to me, it should be like a song, one song from beginning to end, mm-hmm. like one aria, one thing, because he said people have to understand it the first time they hear it. You know, so I changed my mind, I changed my pencil, and I tried, and finally we came up with what, you know.
Yeah, and it's jazz and ballads. And
yeah, but mostly it's melodic, you know, from
very
beginning
melodic.
To end. Yeah,
well, beautiful
right.
chords also.
Yeah, because, you know, they exist, so we have to use them.
What's that?
The chords, I mean, you know, we have to use the chords which are existing, so we use almost all of them.
Now, in a lot of ways, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg to me is like if you made An Ordinary Life into an MGM musical, and you took the sets of an MGM musical and combined that with the gas station on the corner, what would you get? Because
yeah.
it takes the scenes of Ordinary Life and kind of elevates it to the beauty of an MGM musical. Was that what you both had in mind?
No, we wanted to do a very ordinary story. You know, the ordinary triangle, because, you know, this beautiful young girl, she does not wait for her lover to come back, and she marries someone else. At the same time, we wanted to use very ordinary, everyday language, simple, mm-hmm. very simple. So the music had to be very melodic, but exactly like one song from beginning to end, you know. And then the color will be very exaggerated. So it will be like it's a huge dream in a very ordinary life. This is what we wanted to, we tried to achieve. We never thought of American musical, nor MGM, nor anything. You know, just a French, typical French story in a provincial town with simple people, beautiful people, but simple.
Now, was the dialogue written first? Did Demi give you the dialogue and say, okay, now you can compose a score around it?
Yeah, because Jacques, you know, originally I had written the dialogues on every scene. Since the dummy wanted to shoot it as a normal movie, without music, without, you know, singing. And so we took scene by scene, and, you know, I come up with a tempo, with a melody, and then we changed, in every scene, we changed all the dialogue. Because I said, Jacques, no, here I want da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So he adapted everything, and then he put one syllable under every note that I was proposing to him. So we worked almost, you know, we worked both together from beginning to end.
Now, I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to set the scenes that aren't the more romantic or disillusioned scenes, but just the more everyday scenes. Like, in the very beginning, there's a scene where Guy, you know, the romantic lead, is working at the gas station, and
yeah.
he's just fixed a customer's car.
Yeah.
And Guy says, "Finished," and the customer says, "It rattles a bit when the motor's cold, but that's normal." That's yeah. not the typical stuff that people set to music.
No, absolutely not. No, this is why. And also, you know, when we decided to start, the film with jazz, with loud, you know, blurring jazz, you know, tune, to really shock the people for a few minutes and then come back to, you know, a nicer, more romantic melody. We wanted to shock first, to be able, because, you know, it was, we always, Jacques and I said that we know that our movie is not going to be commercial at all. We knew it, so we said we want to do the first of all exactly what we hope to do. Exactly, you know, he sees it. I was hearing it, and we said it's a pure, completely without any compromise. Exactly what we want to do, and we decided on the emotion, you know, in every page, in every line. And working, you know, it's beautiful to work together, because any idea I had for lyrics, any idea I had for music, we discussed it and we were together to decide to use it or not.
Why don't we hear the music from that opening scene in the gas station,
okay,
where Guy has just finished working on a car.
Yes, and you know what's funny? Because the movie starts with, c'est terminé, it's finished. So we laughed, you know, Jacques and I said, because we start with, it's over.
Right, and he's saying it's finished to the customer whose car he just finished.
Yeah.
Okay, here it is.
C'est terminé, oui. Le moteur cliquait encore un peu à froid, mais c'est normal. Merci, merci. Faire une heure ce soir. Ce soir ça m'est difficile, mais je pense que Pierre est libre. Pierre, est-ce que tu peux rester ce soir?
Oui, tu vérifieras l'allumage de la Mercedes de monsieur.
This music from the opening scene of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which has just been re-released in a beautiful new print. My guest is the composer Michel Legrand. How else it was writing the score for this movie different from writing more conventional songs? Were you just writing a regular song?
No. It was very different because, first of all, you have to find the style, the overall style from beginning to end. So I used jazz, I used, you know, romantic things, I used, you know, many kind of ingredients, you know, in my cooking, to try to find the style, and it's sometimes pseudo classical, sometimes but I think it's everything is in one very serious and very rigorous style. As soon as you find it, then you have to find the melodies, which goes very well with one before, you know, bringing the new one coming up. And so it's not a song work really. Because a song has, you know, a beginning and an end, and it ends, and there is never any end. So it's a very different work.
My guest is Michel Legrand, who composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The movie has been restored and is now out on video. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michel Legrand. He composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. A restored edition of the movie is out on video. Our interview was recorded last year after the restoration was released theatrically. Even though you weren't setting out to write songs, there were a couple of songs from The Umbrellas of Cherbourg that became very famous on their own and had a life outside of the movie. And I'm thinking from the main theme, which is known, I think, to a lot of Americans as I Will Wait for You,
mm-hmm,
and Watch What Happens.
Sure. But, I mean, you know, we can all, anyone can always, you know, extract from a score, I mean, one melody and use it, you know, as a separate item.
Were you surprised that these became songs and became hits on their own?
Very much surprised, I'll tell you, because, first of all, Jacques and I, we couldn't find any producer in Paris who would put one franc in an adventure like that. Nobody believed in it. We auditioned, you know, to every possible producer in Paris, and nobody wanted to produce it because they said, no, you're a couple of young, you know, nice guys, but I don't believe that the audience will stay for 90 minutes, you know, in a dark theater while people on the screen are singing, give me the sword, but then singing, say no, it will never work. So hearing that for about a year, because, you know, we auditioned about for a complete year, Jacques and I, we knew that, you know, our movies, if by any miracle we could make it, would be a flop for sure.
And of course the movie was not a flop, and neither was the music.
Yes, it's very funny because, you know, at the opening night, you know, at the opening night, right away it was a success. So we were the first one amazed about it.
Now, I believe that none of the actors in Umbrellas of Cherbourg did their own singing. I believe each actor had a singer that dubbed for him or her. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Because Jacques wanted to have the exact, you know, actor or actress for each role. And I wanted to have the best singer, male or female, for each character. But it was easy, you know, because nobody is speaking one word in that movie. So we could choose any kind of singing voice, you know.
Now, when you were shooting the movie,
yeah,
and the actors had to lip sync to, yeah, the singers, was it hard for the,
no,
actors to get it just right and to,
no,
really be... Because so many movies where, you know, where it's dubbed like that, it looks really phony.
I know. But, I mean, you know, I was very, very careful with it because when we recorded the singers, we asked the actors to be there at the recording studio. And we said to the actors, you have to say, bonjour, quelle heure est-il? How would you say that if you had to talk? So they said, bonjour, je vais bien. So we said to the singers, so you have to, you know, listen to the actor and try to sing in the speed that the actor would normally say it. So we worked very closely, you know, actors and singers together. All the actors were there when the singers were singing their parts in the studio with the orchestra. And after that, you know, we did some acetate discs, and we forced every actor and actress, you know, in the cast to work for a couple of months every day. And I was there with them almost every day to learn very well, you know, the music, the score. So when Jacques started shooting, they knew it very, very well. They rehearsed, and we rehearsed so many times that they knew it well. And my job during the shooting was behind the camera to look if every actor was in sync with their voices.
Now, what,
and they were beautifully. They knew it so well.
What did it sound like when the actors, in order to be convincing, were actually singing, even though you weren't recording their voices because their voices were being dubbed? But they had to actually sing so that they'd look convincing. Did they sing well, or was it funny to listen to?
No, it was funny to listen to because they don't sing well. But I said, you know, you have to sing. Don't just, you know, move your lips. Scream, even if it's out of key. I don't care. But we must see, you know, you singing and acting. So they did it very well, very well.
I wish I could hear what that sounded like. I wish there was a recording of that.
No, I'm glad that you never heard it.
Instead, why don't we hear some more music from the original recording? This is one of the beautiful melodies from Umbrellas of Cherbourg that you composed. This is Americans will know it as Watch What Happens. Mm-hmm. But... this was so interesting to me because I knew the song first as Watch What Happens, which,
yep,
you know, was a very kind of popular pop hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's such, the second time it's sung in the movie, it's a song of such longing and disillusionment and love. I mean, there's a diamond merchant who's fallen in, mm-hmm, love with the leading lady, and he, mm-hmm, knows that she's in love with somebody else,
mm-hmm,
but he knows that she was made for him. And he goes to her mother and says this: once I loved a woman, but she did not love me. Her name was Lola. Once disillusioned, I tried to forget. I left the country and went to the end of the world, but life was meaningless. Then by chance, I met you, and the moment I saw Genevieve, I knew she was made for me. And it's sung to this melody, a beautiful melody. Why don't we hear it, and then I'll talk to you about writing it.
Good.
Autrefois, j'ai aimé une femme, elle ne m'aimait pas, on l'appelait Lola. Autrefois, déçu, j'ai voulu oublier, alors j'ai quitté la France, je suis allé au bout du monde. La vie me paraissait sans attrait, et puis le hasard. m'a mis sur votre route. Dès que j'ai vu Geneviève, j'ai su que je l'attendais. Depuis cette rencontre, ma vie a pris un autre sens. À tout instant, c'est elle que je vois. Je ne vis que pour elle. Je ne pense plus qu'à elle. J'ai voulu vous parler franchement. Vous ne m'en voudrez pas. Il n'est bien sûr pas question d'influencer Geneviève. Geneviève Elie.
Michel Legrand, what did you think about when writing this lovely melody?
You know, I thought of this is what the film wanted at that moment. You know, it was not just one melody; it was part of the entire work. And when I found it, I said, I think it would be very beautiful there. So we tried, and it worked. That's very simple. I mean, it looks, you know, on surface very simple. It's not, but this is the best way that I would like to explain it.
You mean like the intervals are more surprising than you'd think?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, it's funny because the discourse seems very, very simple. And, you know, it's like three notes, but it's very complicated.
Tell me why it's complicated.
Because, you know, for me, the quality of a melody should, even if the melody is very complicated by itself, should sound to you like it existed for 1,000 years already. It should sound so natural. It should float naturally, like a bird singing his song. So I always try to, even if it's torn, you know, if it's complicated, sophisticated, it has to sound to you very natural. This is why I'm always looking when I write a melody, in any style, you know, in any discipline. And this is what I tried on Cherbourg too.
Now, how did the song that we just heard, in which one of the characters sings about his lost love, how did that become Watch What Happens, the American pop hit?
Because, you know, when we finished the film, then I went to New York and I met a friend. I had a friend, his name is Don Costa. Don Costa was a very famous orchestrator in New York, beautiful, very good musician. And I said to the listener, that's why he said, oh, I said, Michel, that's great. He said, why don't I publish it? And why don't, you know, we extract a couple, two or three tunes from that and try to make some songs out of it? I said, fine, go. So Don called Norman Gimbel, you know, the American lyricist. And Norman wrote I Will Wait For You, and he wrote Watch What Happens. So we were very happy with it, and this is how it became, you know, songs.
My guest is Michel Legrand, who composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The movie has been restored and is now out on video. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michel Legrand, he composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. A restored edition of the movie is now out on home video. Our interview was recorded last year after the restoration was released theatrically. Earlier when you were talking about how you and the director Jacques Demy were first conceiving of Umbrellas of Cherbourg, you said that one of the difficult things when you were thinking it would be a conventional musical was how do you get from the speaking parts to the singing parts? That transition on film always looks awkward. People always have a hard time with that. Have you, what has it been like for you to do musicals where you do have to make that transition from speaking to singing, where it's not sung all the way through?
We did, because right after Cherbourg, I mean, the success of Cherbourg, every producer who refused to produce Cherbourg came to us and said, oh, great, you guys, make us another Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Yes, we said, no, thank you. We've done it once. It's over. Now we'll do something else. And then we did a conventional, or so-called conventional musical called The Young Girls of Rochefort with spoken parts and singing parts. And then I think we achieved pretty well, you know, the transition between what's said and what's sung.
And was it hard to make that transition between what's said and what's sung?
Hard, yes. Everything is hard. But it, you know, you have to be extremely keen and extremely, you know, subtle to bring the music when, you know, and suddenly, naturally, someone starts to sing. Not easy.
Michel Legrand, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, it was a pleasure.
Michel Legrand composed the music for the 1964 film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The restored version is now out on home video. Our interview was recorded last year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Bob Purdick, and Chris Fraley. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester. I'm Terry Gross.
Mon amour, oh mon amour,
Geneviève. Ma petite Geneviève,
Guy, je t'aime. Tu sens l'essence.
C'est un parfum comme un autre.
Guy, je t'aime. Oh Guy, je t'aime. Un client, je me sauve à 8 heures devant le théâtre. J'ai pensé à toi toute la journée. Si tu veux mon amour, après nous irons danser.
Si tu veux.
Si tu veux. Vous désirez
un parapluie.
Un parapluie. Où étais-tu? Là, en face. Êtes-vous fixé sur le genre d'article qui vous intéresse?
Un parapluie noir.
Geneviève, montre les parapluies à monsieur.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Mary Gordon. Her father died when she was 7. She's always said that's the most important thing you can know about her. But her sense of who she was changed when she uncovered the lies her father had built his identity on. Her memoir about her father has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.